Cassette 11, Side 2. All this growth had been aided by huge deposits of sodium nitrate that had been lying in Candor and Ophir canyons, great white bench terraces made of extremely water-soluble caliche blanco. These mineral deposits were now melting over the canyon floors and running down the streams, providing the new soils with lots of nitrogen. Unfortunately, some of the biggest nitrate deposits were being buried under landslides. The water that was dissolving the sodium nitrate was also hydrating the canyon walls, destabilizing them in a radical acceleration of the mass wasting that went on all the time. No one went near the foot of the canyon walls anymore, the flyers said. Too dangerous. And as they soared around in their blimp gliders, Nergal saw the scars of landslides everywhere. Several high talus plant slopes had been buried, and wall-fixing methods were one of the many topics of conversation in the Mesa evenings after the Omegan dwarf got into the blood. In fact, there was little they could do. If chunks of a 10,000-foot-high wall of rock wanted to give way, nothing was going to stop them. So from time to time, about once a week or so, everyone on Shining Mesa would feel the ground quiver, watch the tent shimmer, and hear in the pit of the stomach the low rumble of a collapse. Often it was possible to spot the slide rolling across the canyon floor ahead of a sienna billow of dust. Flyers in the air nearby would come back shaken and silent, or voluble with tales of being slapped across the sky by ear-splitting roars. One day Nergal was about halfway down to the floor when he felt one himself. It was like a sonic boom that went on for many seconds, the air quivering like a gel. Then, just as suddenly as it had begun, it was over. Mostly he explored on his own. Sometimes he flew with his old acquaintances. Blimp gliders were perfect for the canyon, slow and steady, easy to steer. More loft than was needed, more power. The one he had rented, using money from Coyote, allowed him to drift down in the mornings to help botanize in the forests or walk by the streams, then float back up through the afternoons, up and up and up and up. This was when one got a true sense of just how tall Candor Mesa was, and the even taller canyon walls, up, up and up and up, to the tent, and its long meals, its party nights. Day after day, Nergal followed this routine, exploring the various regions of the canyons below, watching the exuberant nightlife in the tent, but seeing everything as if through the wrong end of a telescope. A telescope consisting of the question, is this the life I want to lead? This distancing and somehow miniaturizing question kept returning to him, spurring him by day as he banked in the sunlight, haunting him at night in sleepless hours between the time slip and dawn. What was he to do? The success of the revolution had left him without a task. All his life he had wandered Mars talking to people about a free Mars, about inhabitation rather than colonization, about becoming indigenous to the land. Now that task was ended. The land was theirs to live on as they chose. But in this new situation, he found he didn't know his part. He had to think very specifically about how to go on in this new world, no longer as the voice of the collective, but as an individual in his own private life. He had discovered that he didn't want to continue working on the collective. It was good that some people wanted to do it, but he wasn't one of them. In fact, he couldn't think about Cairo without a stab of anger at Jackie, and of simple pain as well. Pain at the loss of that public world, that whole way of life. It was hard to give up being a revolutionary. Nothing seemed to follow from it, either logically or emotionally. But something had to be done. That life was past. In the midst of a banking slow dive in his blimp glider, he suddenly understood Maya and her obsessive talk about incarnations. He was 27 years old now. He had crisscrossed all Mars, he had been to Earth, he had returned to a free world. Time for the next metempsychosis. So he flew around the immensities of Candor, looking for some image of himself. The fractured, layered, scarred canyon walls were so many stupendous mineral mirrors. And indeed he saw clearly that he was a tiny creature, smaller than a gnat in a cathedral. Flying around, studying each great palimpsest of facets, he scried two very strong impulses in himself, distinct and mutually exclusive, yet enfolded, like the green and the white. On the one hand, he wanted to stay a wanderer, to fly and walk and sail over all the world, a nomad forever, wandering ceaselessly until he knew Mars better than anyone else. Ah, yes, it was a familiar euphoria. On the other hand, it was familiar. He had done that all his life. It would be the form of his previous life without the content. And he knew already the loneliness of that life, the rootlessness that made him feel so detached, that gave him this wrong end of the telescope vision. Coming from everywhere, he came from nowhere. He had no home. And so now he wanted that home as much as the freedom or more, a home. He wanted to settle into a full human life, to pick a place and stay there, to learn it completely in all its seasons, to grow his food, make his house and his tools, become part of a community of friends. Both these desires existed strongly and together, or, to be more exact, in a subtle, rapid oscillation which jangled his emotions and left him insomniac and restless. He could see no way to reconcile the two. They were mutually exclusive. No one he talked to had any useful suggestions as to how to resolve the difficulty. Coyote was dubious about setting down roots, but then he was a nomad and didn't know. Art considered the wandering life impossible, but he was fond of his places now. Nergal's non-political training was in mesocosm engineering, but he found that little help to his thinking. At the higher elevations, they were always going to be intense, and mesocosm engineering would be needed, but it was becoming more of a science than an art, and with increasing experience, solving the problems would be more and more routinized. Besides, did he want to pursue a tented profession when so much of the lower planet was becoming land they could walk on? No, he wanted to live in the open air, to learn a patch of land, its soil and plants and animals and weather and skies and everything else. He wanted that. Part of him, part of the time. He began to feel, however, that whatever he chose, Kander Kazma was not the place for the kind of settlement he was thinking of. Its huge vistas made it a hard place to see as home. It was too vast, too inhuman. The canyon floors were designed and designated as wilderness, and every spring the streams surging with snowmelt would jump their banks, tear new channels, be buried under enormous landslides. Fascinating, all of it, but not home. The locals were going to stay up on Shining Mesa and only visit the canyon floors during the day. The Mesa would be their true home. It was a good plan. But the Mesa, it was an island in the sky, a great tourist destination, a place for flying vacations, for partying through the nights, for expensive hotels, for the young and the in love. All that was fine, wonderful, but crowded, perhaps even overrun, or else always battling the influx of visitors and newly settled residents enchanted by the sublime views, people who would arrive like Nergal himself, dropping in at some dusk in their life and never going away, while the old residents looked on helplessly and grumbled about the good old days when the world had been new and unoccupied. No, that was not the kind of home he had in mind. Although he loved the way dawn flushed the fluted west walls of Kander, flaring all across the Martian spectrum, the sky turning indigo or mauve or a startling earthly cerulean, a beautiful place, so beautiful that on some days as he flew about, he felt it would be worth it to stand on Shining Mesa and hold his ground, to try to preserve it, to swoop down and learn the gnarly wilderness floor, float back up every afternoon to dinner. Would that work? Make him feel at home? And if wilderness was what he wanted, weren't there other places less spectacular but more remote, thus more wild? Back and forth he went, back and forth. One day, flying over the foaming, opaque series of waterfalls and rapids in the Kander Gap, he remembered that John Boone had been through this area in a solo rover just after the Trans-Marineris Highway had been built. What would that master equivocator have said about this amazing region? Nergal called up Boone's AI, Pauline, and asked for Kander, and found a voice diary made during a drive through the canyon in 2046. Nergal let the tape run as he looked down on the land from above, listening to the hoarse voice with the friendly American accent, a voice unself-conscious about talking to an AI. Listening to the voice made Nergal wish he could really talk to the man. Some people said Nergal had filled John Boone's empty shoes, that Nergal had done the work John would have done had he lived. If that were so, what would John have done afterward? How would he have lived? This is the most unbelievable country I've ever seen. Really, it's what you think of when you think of Valles Marineris. Back in Mellis, the canyon was so wide that out in the middle you couldn't see the walls at all. They were under the horizon. This small planet curvature is producing effects no one ever imagined. All the old simulations lied so bad, the verticals exaggerated by factors of 5 or 10, as I recall, which made it look like you were down in a slot. It's not a slot. Wow, there's a rock column just like a woman in a toga. Lot's wife, I guess that would be. I wonder if it's salt. It's white. But I guess that doesn't mean much. Have to ask Anne. I wonder what those Swiss road builders made of all this when they built this road. It's not very alpine. Kind of like an anti-Alps, down instead of up, red instead of green, basalt instead of granite. Well, but they seem to like it anyway. Of course, they're anti-Swiss, so it makes a kind of sense. Whoa, pothole country here. The rover is bouncing around. Might try that bench there. Looks smoother than here. Yep, there we go. Just like a road. Oh, it is the road. I guess I got off it a bit. I'm driving manually for the fun of it, but it's hard to keep an eye out for the transponders when there's so much else to look at. The transponders are made more for automatic pilot than the human eye. Hey, there's the break into Ophir Chasma. What a gap. That wall must be, I don't know, 20,000 feet tall. My lord. Since the last one was called Kander Gap, this one should be called Ophir Gap, right? Ophir Gate would be nicer. Let's check the map. The promontory on the west side of the gap is called Kander Labies. That's lips, isn't it? Kander Throat, or... I don't think so. It's one hell of an opening, though. Steep cliffs on both sides and 20,000 feet tall. That's about 6 or 7 times as tall as the cliffs in Yosemite. Shit! They don't look that much taller, to tell the truth. Foreshortening, no doubt. They look about twice as tall, or... who knows? I can't remember what Yosemite really looked like in terms of size anyway. This is the most amazing canyon you could ever even imagine. Ah, there's Kander Mensa on my left. This is the first time I could see that it isn't part of the Kander Labies wall. I'll bet that mesa top has one hell of a view. Put a fly-in hotel up there, sure. I wish I could get up there and see it. This would be a fun place to fly around in. Dangerous, though. I see dust devils every now and then, vicious little things, real tight and dark. There's a shaft of sunlight there hitting the mesa through the dust, like a bar of butter hanging in the air. Ah, God, what a beautiful world. Nergal could only agree. It made him laugh to hear the man's voice, and surprised him to hear John talk about flying above. It made him understand a little bit the way the Issei talked about Boone, the hurt in them that never went away. How much better it would be to have John here than just these recordings in an AI. What a great adventure it would have been to watch John Boone negotiate Mars's wild history. Saving Nergal the burden of that role, among other things. As it was, however, they only had that friendly, happy voice. And that didn't solve his problem. Back up on Kander Mesa, the Flyers met at night in a ring of pubs and restaurants placed on the high southern arc of their tent wall, where on terraces just inside the tent they could sit and look out at the long views over the forested world of their domain. Nergal sat among these people, eating and drinking, listening, sometimes talking, thinking his own thoughts among them, comfortably. They didn't care what had happened to him on Earth. They didn't care that he was among them. This was good, as often as he was distracted to the point of being oblivious to his surroundings. He would fall into reveries and come out of them and realize that once again he had been in the steamy streets of Port of Spain, or in the refugee compound in the torrential monsoon. How often he found himself there again. Everything that had happened since was so pale by comparison. But one night he came to from a reverie, having heard some voice say, "Hiroko!" "What's that?" he said. "Hiroko, we met her flying around Elysium up on its northern slope." It was a young woman speaking, her face innocent of any knowledge of who he was. "You saw her yourself?" he said sharply. "Yes, she's not hiding or anything. She said she liked my flyer."
"I don't know," an older man said. A Mars vet, an Issei immigrant from the early years, his face battered by wind and cosmic rays until it looked like leather, voice hoarse. "I heard she was down in the chaos where the first hidden colony used to be, working on the new harbors in the South Bay."
Other voices cut in. Hiroko had been seen here, had been seen there, had been confirmed dead, had gone to Earth. Nergal had seen her there on Earth.
"This here's Nergal," one said to the last comment, pointing and grinning. "He should be able to confirm or deny that one."
Nergal, taken aback, nodded.
"I didn't see her on Earth," he said. "There were rumors only." "Same as here, then."
Nergal shrugged. The young woman, flushed now that she knew who Nergal was, insisted she had met Hiroko herself. Nergal watched her closely. This was different. No one had ever made such a direct claim to him, except in Switzerland. She looked worried, defensive, but was holding her ground.
"I talked with her, I say."
Why lie about something like that? And how would it be possible for someone to get fooled about it? Impersonators? But why do that? Despite himself, Nergal's pulse had quickened and he was warmer. The thing was, it was possible Hiroko would do something like this. Hide but not hide. Live somewhere without bothering to contact the family left behind. There was no obvious motive for it. It would be weird, inhumane, inhuman, and perfectly within Hiroko's range of possibilities. His mother was a kind of insane person. He had understood that for years. A charismatic who led people effortlessly, but was mad, capable of almost anything. If she was alive. He did not want to hope again. He did not want to go chasing off after the mere mention of her name. But he was watching this girl's face as if he could read the truth from it, as if he could catch the very image of Hiroko still there in her pupils. Others were asking the questions he would have asked, so he could stay silent and listen. He didn't have to make her over self-conscious. Slowly, she told the whole story. She and some friends had been flying clockwise around Elysium, and when they stopped for the night up on the new peninsula made by the Phlegra Montes, they had walked down to the icy edge of the North Sea, where they had spotted a new settlement, and there in the crowd of construction workers was Hiroko. And several of the construction crew were her old associates, Jean and Raya and Awao, and the rest of the first 100 who had followed Hiroko ever since the days of the Lost Colony. The flying group had been amazed, but the Lost Colonists had been faintly perplexed at their amazement. "No one hides anymore," Hiroko had told the young woman after complimenting her flyer. "We spend most of our time near Dorsa Brevia. But we've been up here for months now." And there it was. The woman seemed perfectly sincere. There was no reason to believe she were lying or subject to hallucination.
Nergal didn't want to have to think about this, but he had been considering leaving Shining Mesa anyway and having a look around at other places, so he could. And, well, he was going to have to at least have a look. Shigata Ganai. The next day the conversation seemed much less compelling. Nergal didn't know what to think. He called Sax on the wrist, told him what he had heard. "Is it possible, Sax? Is it possible?" A strange look passed over Sax's face. "It's possible," he said. "Yes, of course. I told you, when you were sick and unconscious, that she..." He was picking his words, as he so often did, with a squint of concentration. "That I saw her myself, in that storm I was caught out in. She led me to my car." Nergal stared at the little blinking image.
"I don't remember that."
"Ah, I'm not surprised.
So you think she escaped from Sabashii?"
"Yes."
"But how likely was that?"
"I don't know the likelihood. That would be difficult to judge."
"But could she have slipped away?"
"The Sabashii Moho Mound is a maze."
"So you think they escaped?"
Sax hesitated. "I saw her. She grabbed my wrist. I have to believe."
Suddenly his face twisted.
"Yes, she's out there. She's out there. I have no doubt. No doubt. No doubt. She's expecting us to come to her."
And Nergal knew he had to look. He left Kander Mesa without a goodbye to anyone. His acquaintances there would understand. They often flew away themselves for a time. They would all be back someday to soar over the canyons and then spend their evenings together on Shining Mesa. And so he left. Down into the immensity of Melis Chasma, then down canyon again, east into Coprates. For many hours he floated in that world, over the 61 glacier, past embayment after embayment, buttress after buttress, until he was through the Dover Gate and out over the broadening divergence of Capri and Eos chasmas. Then above the ice-filled chaoses, the crackled ice smoother by far than the drowned land below it had been. Then across the rough jumble of Margarita for Terra and north, following the Piste toward Burrows. Then as the Piste approached Libya Station, he banked off to the northeast toward Elysium. The Elysium Massif was now a continent in the northern sea. The narrow strait separating it from the southern mainland was a flat stretch of black water and white tabular bergs, punctuated by the Stack Islands, which had been the Aeolus Mensa. The North Sea hydrologists wanted this strait liquid so that currents could make their way through it from Isidus Bay to Amazonas Bay. To help achieve this liquidity, they had placed a nuclear reactor complex at the west end of the strait and pumped most of its energy into the water there, creating an artificial polynya where the surface stayed liquid year-round and a temperate mesoclimate on the slopes on each side of the strait. The reactor's steam plumes were visible to Nergal from far up the great escarpment, and as he floated down the slope, he crossed over thickening forests of fir and ginkgo. There was a cable across the western entrance to the strait, emplaced to snag icebergs floating in on the current. He flew directly over the berg jam west of the cable and looked down on chunks of ice like floating drift glass. Then over the black open water of the strait, the biggest stretch of open water he had ever seen on Mars. For 20 kilometers he floated over the open water, exclaiming out loud at the sight. Then ahead, an immense airy bridge arced over the strait. The black-violet plate of water below it was dotted with sailboats, ferries, long barges, all trailing the white V's of their wakes. Nergal floated over them, circling the bridge twice to marvel at the sight, like nothing he had ever seen on Mars before. Water. The sea.
A whole future world.
He continued north, rising over the plains of Cerberus, past the volcano Albor Tholus, a steep ash cone on the side of Elysium Mons. The much bigger Elysium Mons was steep as well, with a Fuji-esque profile that served as the label illustration for many agricultural co-ops in the region. Sprawled over the plain under the volcano were farms, mostly ragged at the edges, often terraced and usually divided by strips or patches of forest. Young, immature orchards dotted the higher parts of the plain, each tree in a pot. Closer to the sea were great fields of wheat and corn, cut by windbreaks of olive and eucalyptus. Just 10 degrees north of the equator, blessed with rainy mild winters and then lots of hot sunny days, the people there called it the Mediterranean of Mars. Farther north, Nergal followed the west coast as it rose up out of a line of foundered icebergs embroidering the edge of the ice sea. As he looked down at the expanse of land below, he had to agree with the general wisdom. Elysium was beautiful. This western coastal strip was the most populated region, he had heard. The coast was fractured by a number of fossae, and square harbors were being built where these canyons plunged into the ice. Tyre, Sidon, Pyriphlegethon, Hertzka, Morris. Often stone breakwaters stopped the ice, and marinas were in place behind the breakwaters, filled with fleets of small boats, all waiting for open passage. At Hertzka, Nergal turned east and inland, and flew up the gentle slope of Elysian Massif, passing over garden belts banding the land. Here the majority of Elysium's thousands lived, in intensively cultivated agricultural residential zones, sloping up into the higher country between Elysium Mons and its northern spur cone, Hecate's Tholus. Between the great volcano and its daughter peak, Nergal flew through the bare rock saddle of the pass, flung like a little cloud by the pass wind. Elysium's east slope looked nothing like the west. It was bare, rough, torn rock, heavily sand-drifted, maintained in nearly its primordial condition by the rain shadow of the massif. Only near the eastern coast did Nergal see greenery below him again, no doubt nourished by trade winds and winter fogs. The towns on the east side were like oases, strung on the thread of an island-circling piste. At the far northeast end of the island, the ragged old hills of the Phlegra Montes ran far out into the ice, forming a spiny peninsula. Somewhere around here was where that young woman had seen Hiroko. As Nergal flew up the western side of the Phlegras, it struck him as a likely place to find her. It was a wild and Martian place. The Phlegras, like many of the great mountain ranges of Mars, was the only remaining arc of an ancient impact basin's rim. Every other aspect of that basin had long since disappeared. But the Phlegras still stood as witness to a minute of inconceivable violence, impact of 100-kilometer asteroid, big pieces of the lithosphere melted and shoved sideways, other pieces tossed into the air to fall in concentric rings around the impact point, with much of the rock metamorphosed instantly into minerals much harder than their originals. After that trauma, the wind had cut away at things, leaving behind only these hard hills. There were settlements out here, of course, as there were everywhere, in the sinkholes and dead-end valleys and on the passes overlooking the sea. Isolated farms, villages of 10 or 20 or 100. It looked like Iceland. There were always people who liked such remote land. One village perched on a flat knob 100 meters over the sea was called Nuannarpok, which was Inuit for taking extravagant pleasure in being alive. These villagers and all the others in the Phlegras could float to the rest of Elysium on blimps or walk down to the Circum-Elysian Piste and catch a ride. For this coast in particular, the nearest town would be a shapely harbor called Firewater on the west side of the Phlegras, where they first became a peninsula. The town stood on a bench at the end of a squarish bay, and when Nergal spotted it, he descended onto the tiny airstrip at the upper end of town, and then checked into a boarding house on the main square behind the dock standing over the ice-sheeted marina. In the days that followed, he flew out along the coast in both directions, visiting farm after farm. He met a lot of interesting people, but none of them was Hiroko or anyone from the zygote crowd, not even any of their associates. It was even a little suspicious. A fair number of Issei lived in the region, but every one of them denied ever having met Hiroko or any of her group. Yet all of them were farming with great success, in rocky wilderness that didn't look easy to farm, cultivating exquisite little oases of agricultural productivity, living the lives of believers in Veriditas. But no, never met her. Barely remembered who she was. One ancient geezer of an American laughed in his face. "What y'all think? We got a guru? We gonna lead you to our guru?" After 3 weeks, Nergal had found no sign of her at all. He had to give up on the Phlegramontes. There was no other choice. Ceaseless wandering. It didn't make sense to search for a single person over the vast surface of a world. It was an impossible project. But in some villages there were rumors and sometimes sightings. Always one more rumor, sometimes one good sighting. She was everywhere and nowhere. Many descriptions, but never a photo. Many stories, but never a wrist message. Sax was convinced she was out there. Coyote was sure she wasn't. It didn't matter. If she was out there, she was hiding, or leading him on a wild goose chase. It made him angry when he thought of it that way. He would not search for her. Yet he couldn't stop moving. If he stayed in one place for more than a week, he began to feel nervous and fretful in a way he had never felt in his life. It was like an illness, with tension everywhere in his muscles, but concentrated in his stomach. An elevated temperature. Inability to focus on his thoughts, an urge to fly. And so he would fly from village to town to station to caravanserai. Some days he let the wind carry him where it would. He had always been a nomad, no reason to stop now. A change in the form of government, why should that make a difference in the way he lived? The winds of Mars were amazing. Strong, irregular, loud, ceaseless live beings at play. Sometimes the wind carried him out over the northern sea, and he flew all day and never saw anything but ice and water, as if Mars were an ocean planet. That was Vastatas Borealis, the vast north, now ice. The ice was in some places flat, in others shattered, sometimes white, sometimes discolored. The red of dust, or the black of snow algae, or the jade of ice algae, or the warm blue of clear ice. In some places, big dust storms had stalled and dropped their loads, and then the wind had carved the detritus so that little dune fields were created, looking just like old Vastatas. In some places, ice carried on currents had crashed over crater rim reefs, making circular pressure ridges. In other places, ice from different currents had crashed together, creating straight pressure ridges like dragonbacks. Open water was black, or the various purples of the sky. There was a lot of it. Polynyas, leads, cracks, patches. Perhaps a third of the sea's surface now. Even more common were melt lakes lying on the surface of the ice, their water white and sky-colored both, which at times looked a brilliant light violet, but other times separated out into the two colors. Yes, it was another version of the green and the white, the enfolded world, two in one. As always, he found the sight of a double color disturbing, fascinating. The secret of the world. Many of the big drilling platforms in Vastatas had been seized by reds and blown up. Black wreckage scattered over white ice. Other platforms were defended by greens and being used now to melt the ice. Large polynyas stretched to the east of these platforms, and the open water steamed as if clouds were pouring up out of a submarine sky. In the clouds, in the wind, the southern shore of the northern sea was a succession of gulfs and headlands, bays and peninsulas,
fjords and capes, sea stacks and low archipelagos. Nergal followed it for day after day, landing in the late afternoons at little new seaside settlements. He saw crater islands with interiors lower than the ice and water outside the rim. He saw some places where the ice seemed to be receding so that bordering the ice were black strands raked by parallel lines running down to ragged drift errata of jumbled rock and ice. Would these strands flood again, or would they grow wider still? No one in these seaside towns knew. No one knew where the coastline would stabilize. The settlements here were made to be moved. Diked polders showed that some people were apparently testing the newly exposed land's fertility. Fringing the white ice, green crop rows. North of Utopia, he passed over a low peninsula that extended from the Great Escarpment all the way to the North Polar Island, the only break in the world-wrapping ocean. A big settlement on this low land, called Boone's Neck, was half-tented and half in the open. The settlement's occupants were engaged in cutting a canal through the peninsula. A wind blew north, and Nergal followed it. The winds hummed, whooshed, keened. On some days they shrieked, live beings at war. In the sea on both sides of the long, low peninsula were tabular ice shelves. Tall mountains of jade ice broke through these white sheets. No one lived up here. But Nergal wasn't searching anymore. He had given up very near despair and was just floating, letting the winds take him like a dandelion seed, over the ice sea, shattered white, over open purple water lined by sun-bright waves. Then the peninsula widened to become the polar island, a white bumpy land in the sea ice. No sign of the primeval swirl pattern of melt valleys. That world was gone. Over the other side of the world in the North Sea, over Orcus Island on the east flank of Elysium, down over Cimmeria again. Floating like a seed, some days the world went black and white, icebergs on the sea looking into the sun, tundra swans against black cliffs, black guillemots flying over the ice, snow geese, and nothing else in all the day. Ceaseless wandering. He flew around the northern parts of the world two or three times, looking down at the land and the ice, at all the changes taking place everywhere, at all the little settlements huddling in their tents or out braving the cold winds. But all the looking in the world couldn't make the sorrow go away. One day he came on a new harbor town at the entry to the long, skinny fjord of Mawrth Vallis, and found his zygote creshmates Rachel and Tiu had moved there. Nergal hugged them, and over dinner and afterward he stared at their oh-so-familiar faces with intense pleasure. Hiroko was gone, but his brothers and sisters remained, and that was something. Proof that his childhood was real. And despite all the years, they looked just like they had when they were children. There was no real difference. Rachel and he had been friends. She had had a crush on him in the early years, and they had kissed in the baths. He recalled with a little shiver a time when she had kissed him in one ear, Jackie in the other. And, though he had almost forgotten it, he had lost his virginity with Rachel one afternoon in the baths, shortly before Jackie had taken him out into the dunes by the lake. Yes, one afternoon, almost accidentally, when their kissing had suddenly become urgent and exploratory, a matter of their bodies moving outside their own volition. Now she regarded him fondly, a woman of his age, her face a map of laugh lines, cheery and bold. She may have recalled their early encounters as little as he did, hard to say what his siblings remembered of their shared bizarre childhood, but she looked like she remembered. She had always been friendly, and she was again now. He told her about his flights around the world, carried by the ceaseless winds, diving slowly against the blimp's buoyancy down to one little habitation after another, asking after Hiroko. Rachel shook her head, smiling ironically. If she's out there, she's out there. but you could look forever and never find her.
Nergal heaved a troubled sigh, and she laughed and tousled his hair.
Don't look for her.
That evening he walked along the strand, just uphill from the devastated berg-strewn shoreline of the northern sea. He felt in his body that he needed to walk, to run. Flying was too easy. It was a dissociation from the world. Things were small and distant. Again, it was the wrong end of the telescope. He needed to walk. Still, he flew. As he flew, however, he looked more closely at the land. Heath, moor, streamside meadows. A creek falling directly into the sea over a short drop, another one crossing a beach. Salt creeks into a fresh ocean. In some places they had planted forests to try to cut down on dust storms that originated in this area. There were still dust storms, but the trees of the forest were saplings still. Hiroko might be able to sort it out. Don't look for her. Look at the land.
This ends side two of cassette 11 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 12.